This episode of Earl Grey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org.
Hi, this is Kwame Kusatsu. I play Admiral Nakamura on Star Trek Next Generation, and welcome you all to Trek FM.
T.L. Greyhawk.
Welcome to another cup of Earl Grey, Trek FM's dedicated podcast to the next generation. I'm your host, Justin Ozer. Amy is away again this week, but join with me today is Joe Keegan. Joe, how are you doing today?
I've been better, Justin, but I can't believe Amy's away still.
Well, she's having fun in Chile.
I know, in Santiago. Yeah. It's crazy.
But she will be back next week, right?
She will be. But she's been posting some amazing pictures and been, the looks of it, been drinking some amazing wine. So I'm super jealous. Never been to South America before.
I haven't either.
I would love to go.
We'll have to ask Amy about it when she comes back. But is that the reason you're not doing so well, because you're jealous of Amy or something?
No,
else?
You'll notice, like on the Zoom video, that I'm wearing a house coat. Or I don't. What do you call house coats in the US?
Jacket?
No, like a bathrobe.
A bathrobe? Oh, okay.
Yeah, like we call it a house coat.
So is it cold there and you don't have heat?
No, we had one of four Christmas nights out last night.
Oh.
So, yeah. I was a bit under the weather this morning, and now I'm just, I feel fine, but now I'm just super tired.
Okay. Well, like, hopefully.
If I randomly fall asleep. Just
well,
like,
hopefully we'll be exciting enough for you to stay awake.
Oh, yeah, I'm so super excited. Yeah. I think adrenaline has now kicked in, so I'm like, oh, focused.
I'm ready to talk about
Star Trek.
So before we get into our main topic, we have some Babel Conference feedback. This was from Earl Grey 300, which was our interview with Robin Curtis. So that was an exciting one because it was the 300th episode of Earl Grey, and we had a great interview with Robin Curtis. Joe, you want to read the first piece of feedback?
Yeah, and about that interview, Robin was just so lovely to talk to, and just so open and warm and friendly. So I'm sorry, my voice is like three octaves and deeper than normal. I might have to edit me kind of up the way.
Like, no, you're
put
fine.
A helium filter on or something. Okay, Rhea Papagiorgio, and just for old time's sake, I'm going to say her name again, Rhea Papagiorgio, says, Gambit Part 1 was on Heroes and Icons last night, and Gambit Part 2 was on tonight. Nice timing, smiley face. Yeah, well, do you know what? We put a lot of thought into organising Earl Grey, and while we might not look at the TV schedules around the world, it's just good luck for us. And so with thanks, we've made your life more enjoyable by talking about stuff that you've just watched on TV. I take it Heroes and Icons is a TV station?
Yeah, it's like a cable station. Okay. And I don't have cable at my house, but my mother-in-law does. She doesn't have the channel. But as I understand it, they have like Star Trek stuff like every night, and they'll run things from all the live action shows. Like, it's pretty cool, actually.
Nice.
And so Gambit was on, which Robin Curtis was in as Talera. And I think on the Tuesday the episode came out, it was the 33rd anniversary of Star Trek IV, which Robin Curtis was also in as Savick.
No.
So how about that? Yeah,
is this something else that we've discovered on Earl Grey, or is this just a commonly known fact? Because you know how we like to discover mind-blowing details.
It seems to happen that we have stuff that's appropriate for certain anniversaries, but we definitely don't plan it that way. It's just,
that's,
you know,
just how good we are. Yeah.
Cool. Don't even have to think about it.
Indeed.
So Chris,
I just say Rhea Papagiorgio? That's it. Then you can go on.
Yes.
Thank you.
That is your three times for the episode.
Yes.
So Chris Hill says, I really enjoyed this one. And if I ever move to Syracuse, New York, I know who I'm using for my real estate agent, LOL. So thanks, Chris. Glad you enjoyed the interview. And as listeners found out, well, or maybe already knew, Robin Curtis is a real estate agent in the Syracuse, New York area and had offered basically her services if people are there or need any real estate help. So yeah, that was pretty great. And she told a really great story about her favorite real estate sale, right?
It was a converted church or something, wasn't it?
A nunnery that was converted for this couple that wanted to use the space, and this guy had like two big grand pianos he wanted in the main area, so it was pretty awesome.
Sounds like my type of house. Thanks for your comment, Chris. Tim Han says, wonderful interview. Well done to all concerned. Robin Curtis really is lovely and such a joy to listen to. I was at Destination Star Trek in October, just checking out the day's schedule information on the wall, not very far away from Curtis' own signing desk, when she stood up and suddenly called out, attention, we have a convention virgin, referring to the people she was signing autographs for. Everyone nearby suddenly stopped what they were doing, laughed and applauded. It was quite a funny moment. Yeah, Tim, I was at Destination Star Trek as well, and I managed to chat to Robin Curtis about coming on to the... I suppose I was following up from Justin talking to her in Vegas, trying to coerce her into coming on, and she was just so delightful. I didn't see the whole convention virgin park. I believe she did it on a few occasions, but... I missed each of them.
Yeah, she was telling that story that she does that. It was great, Tim, that you actually witnessed it. I didn't see that at Star Trek Las Vegas. There must have been lots of people that have been there multiple times like we had. But mm-hmm. It's great. I mean, it seems like she really enjoys talking with the fans and has fun with it. So it's great to hear. Yeah. All right. So today on Earl Grey... we do have a special guest. We really do. So we have April Taylor, who's one of our patrons on Trek FM. So April, welcome to Earl Grey.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's so great to have you here. You know, we met at Star Trek Las Vegas a couple years ago, and I think I saw you this year as well, and I think Joe's met you as well. And,
I have indeed, yes.
Yeah, and you were on a recent roundtable that Chris Littlefield did about Star Trek Las Vegas. Really enjoyed hearing you and the other patrons and guests on that, and we wanted to invite you here to Earl Grey. So as this is your first time, just tell our listeners your history with Star Trek.
Well, I've been a Star Trek fan for a while. My mom used to watch, the syndication of the original Star Trek with my mom. Not all the time, but later on, like in my early 20s is when I was watching TNG at the end of TNG, the beginning of Deep Space Nine and all of that with my roommates a long time ago. We used to all get together, gather in the room and watch those shows. And then Voyager, we were roommates for a while. And then I lost contact with it for a while and revisited some years ago when I was going through some emotional stuff and was at home by myself and watching a lot. I was like, oh yes, Netflix has all of these on now, so I can just watch everything. And I powered through all five series, movies, everything, and just fell in love with it again. Like, I was a fan before, but I wasn't as heavy of a fan as I became after those rewatches. So it just renewed my love of it, and I got to know the characters a bit more and just have been full in ever since. So that's
wonderful. Yeah. I'm just curious. So when you went and rewatched, you know, five different series, how long did that take for you to do?
Because at the time to not go into too much detail, but I was just kind of going through some depression and I was at home a lot. And so it took me like maybe, I don't know, like
a couple of days.
No, not that fast. Maybe a few months, like maybe about 6 months or something like that, just to kind of power watch all of them. Yeah. Yeah. So it was, I mean, it was just like, you know, when you're warned, do you want to continue? I continued every single time, like I was watching.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Who needs sleep?
That's, yeah. Yeah. That's great. So
April, it's a really familiar story for a lot of people that I hear a lot of the time. You grow up watching the original series with a parent. For me, it was my mom as well. And then you later on discover, for me, it was season 3 TNG in the 80s. And then you lose it for a time. Mm-hmm. And you don't have any contact with Star Trek. And then when you come back into it later on, it kind of almost takes over your life and you end up doing podcasts and going to conventions multiple times a year. So it's like, it's such a wonderful fandom to be a part of.
Oh, absolutely.
I totally get why it's a common story for people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So April, when I invited you on, I know we went through lists of possible topics and we eventually came to the one we're talking about today, which is first contacts in TNG. So so tell us why you're interested in this topic.
Well, to be honest, I find with TNG, especially with TNG being like the first of the newer Treks, their handling of it was really interesting because even though they have like this entire idea of a first contact and how it's supposed to go in TNG, almost every single one of them that we saw was unintentional just because of like certain events occurring that caused the first contact to happen. So I just kind of wanted to dig into that a little bit more to see, you know, what can we get out of this and how did Picard and crew manage this idea of a first contact in these situations where everything was just kind of disheveled. So,
yeah, and that's a really interesting point for a lot of them being unintentional. Now, I shall let you know, listeners, I think there are quite a few instances of first contact of some kind or another through the episodes and through the movies. We can't talk about all of them, but you know, I kind of put together a list of the ones I thought might be most interesting or most prominent, or maybe can be used to kind of compare and contrast. So there's actually 7 episodes and a movie that we'll be talking about today. So let's just kind of go right into it. So the first one that I had here is Encounter at Farpoint, which is the first episode of The Next Generation. And what I was thinking about it for primarily is the first contact with the Q. So let me start with you, April. Like, what are your thoughts on that, just thinking about it as like a first contact?
Well, just as a first contact alone, it wasn't initiated by Starfleet.
Yeah.
It was Q kind of just taking over, and although there was kind of another first contact in there, but it was really Q.
Yes.
Yeah, it was Q taking over and starting to decide that he's going to be the judge of this fleet or this crew that's going out and doing things that apparently he doesn't approve that race can do. So it's just a matter of him just jumping in and making himself a part of their their exploration.
Right.
And it's just they're managing him. And Q is not somebody who's really easy to manage, just generally speaking.
Yeah.
He would not allow it. So it's just that take of him, like how they managed or dealt with Q pretty much infiltrating their ship and their journey and their task. So that was not a normal first contact.
Right.
He did, Picard did what he could. But, you know, he's an omnipotent being and kind of a spoiled brat. So.
Yeah, he kind of is. Yeah, and I think it is an interesting choice that right out of the gate in the first episode, the kind of first contact they have is with someone who's superior. And, you know, there are a lot of godlike beings in the original series and all of that. But just to start it out with, okay, here's a challenge for somebody that has so much power over us, I think is pretty interesting. And you did allude to something. I think there is kind of a second first contact in this episode that we'll talk about. But Joe, you know, your impressions of kind of seeing Q and interacting with the Q as a first contact.
So There's so many first contacts in this. I think I maybe counted five, and I've, we'll talk about that a bit later. But
in terms, Encounter at Farpoint?
Yeah, there's so many things that I... It's like when you're podcasting, a topic comes up and you think, like, Justin's time travel. You know, you think about it outside the box slightly sometimes. So there's a few things that I saw as potentially being first contact in some way.
Because I only saw two, but I'll be interested to see what your other three are.
Okay. So, yeah, with the queue, with it being the first episode, Justin, you mentioned that there were lots of godlike beings in the original series. Was that maybe an homage to the original series, having a godlike being, possibly?
The story behind Encounter at Farpoint is that they originally had this idea for what they would be doing, and they kind of went back and forth on the length of it, but the studio was insistent on it being 2 hours. Okay. So Gene Roddenberry had to add to it, and that's when he came up with Q and added it in, possibly because of a inspiration from Trelane from the original series, like that.
Interesting.
It is something that might not have ended up in there, but for needing it to be a 2-hour pilot. And I think it did come from some kind of inspiration from Gene Roddenberry thinking about the original series and coming up with something quickly.
That's quite cool. I suppose with the first episode, it's going into it, you can't really have any expectations about what this new next generation is going to be. So they could really do anything, couldn't they? And having this godlike being, I quite enjoyed it. I think the way Picard deals with him, it's the first glimpse that we get into seeing who Picard is as a person and his command style. I do think the whole episode, with it being the pilot, is a bit more militaristic than we get accustomed to. There's a point where first time we see LaForge, a report to Riker on the planet, and LaForge starts talking, and Riker says, "Oh, is this an official report?" And then LaForge stands to attention and gives the report. And then there's just some of the dialogue, it just feels quite rigid and stilted. But that's not really to do with Q. I enjoyed Q's introduction. And I think the way John Delancey acts it is really important alongside Patrick Stewart. I think they're a really good double act.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's interesting, like, they're on this mission, Q just suddenly appears in a flash of light, and Picard's asking, like, what are you? And Q kind of starts to explain, and then he just kind of goes through all these antics and all these things that are kind of really frustrating. But, I do think it's pretty interesting to see that. April, anything else about Q for this one?
Yeah, I actually kind of like, and I don't know if this is going to be specifically about Q or about it being the first episode of TNG, but I kind of like that introduction of the questioning of Starfleet's mission, or what is it that they're here for? Are they going to be responsible, et cetera, et cetera? Now, granted, we've already had another series prior to, so I'm not sure if, like, you know, Q was kind of hanging back watching everything, you know, during that time, and then decided to just judge because Picard looked like a good easy target. But I kind of like the introduction of just talking about what are you doing here. It gave Picard an opportunity to explain why Starfleet is here, why they're going out exploring, why, you know, the fact that they've gone through all of these hurdles with history and developing themselves in a certain way to prepare them for moving forward and exploring and even learning more about themselves in the process of learning others about others.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting way to think about it, because you could almost think about what goes on with Picard explaining himself and the Enterprise D's mission almost as like trying to explain why Star Trek itself is important and why it's important to think about going out there. And there's also this reflection, you know, thinking back to a previous time when Q brings up kind of this trial setting and talks about the post-atomic horrors and all this stuff, but to try to compare, like, we were there before and here's where we are in a much better place. You have to judge us by how we are now. So in a certain way, I hadn't really thought about it this way, but it's kind of like re-explaining or introducing why Star Trek is important, and in some ways why TNG is important and different because it is this more utopian society. I mean, I think there are aspects of the original series where it's definitely a better future, but there are more things you see in the original series where they're thinking about, you know, famines and other difficulties that don't really seem to happen in the Federation in the 24th century. So it may be a way to kind of, because it's a more powerful being, he has to explain himself and what his ship and the Federation do to Q. I think it's pretty interesting, yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about Encounter at Farpoint since we've talked about the Q. Yes. Now, I'm kind of curious, Joe, you said you thought there were five different first contacts. What are the other ones that you have? I'm just kind of curious because I had one in mind in particular.
Okay, so the obvious, I don't know if it's a first contact, like strictly speaking a first contact, but it's between the Federation and the Bandai on the planet, indigenous people.
Well, I thought they'd had dealings with them prior to this. Yeah,
I thought the same thing too, and I was like, no, okay. I really think that they're not.
Because they made this arrangement with
exactly,
them,
so they already knew about
to have the starbase or whatever.
Okay, yeah. So I've got four first contacts in mind then.
Okay, keep going. We'll see if we knock them down or not.
So there's the space faring
the jellyfish
creature,
yeah.
The jellyfish thing. Yeah. Don't know how much.
Yeah, you talk about your other two, that is the one that I had in mind.
That's the one I had in mind.
Space
as well.
Jellyfish.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think it's the impression I get is it's a species they haven't had contact with before. And it's kind of an interesting way of doing it because it's kind of there through a lot of the episode, but you don't know it because there's this being that's kind of been enslaved. Mm-hmm. And then you get to see them and there's like this understanding and there's all this, you know, like all these things that Troy is feeling from them and, you know, all that. And so that's kind of how the first contact happens. It's not like with Q where you're like talking with him and like, hey, what's mm-hmm. going on? What are you doing here? It more happens through impressions of behavior and certain things that Troy is getting out of it. So it's a little bit different, but
I suppose they're like more like an animal as opposed to a sentient humanoid life form.
Well, I think they are sentient beings though, because I think they do have their own kind of way of communicating or awareness. They just don't do it like verbally.
But yeah, the normal way that we would normally yeah. do.
But yeah, before we talk about that with you a little bit more, mm-hmm. I mean, what do you think about the space jellyfish in this episode, April?
That was my next one. So yeah, I do believe that they are definitely sentient. Like you said, they communicate in a different way. And Troy got to do a, you know, handless or hands-free mind melt with them just by the telecommunication they had yeah. going on. So that was really helpful just for them to kind of identify the fact that they are being hidden. And I that's something I was having a hard time, like who was hiding who? Like, was it I almost said Bao, wrong series,
the Bandai.
They had them captive, or that one jellyfish captive or whatever, using its powers to create things, right? Because I guess that entire society is all, you know, one big giant market. So they were getting things or having things produced in order to sell items, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So it was a good idea or a good thing that Troy was able to sense it, you know, but like what would have happened if there was no Troy? Like, like how would the, you know, they just would have went there, made the purchases, did the, you know, meetup, and then like would have been on and
they'd have been gone before the other one came by.
Exactly.
To wreak its vengeance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Might they have still investigated it because you had the magically
yeah.
reappearing bowl of apples and the bowl of fabric that was red, then red and gold. So
yep.
they might have yeah. noticed that something fishy was up and thought, oh.
Yeah, I mean, they started to notice that already, but they just were
yeah.
kind of questioning themselves a little bit. So, yeah.
Yeah, but I do think it's interesting as a contrast in this episode. You have the Q that are like these omnipotent beings that are kind of and you know, Q as played by John Delancey, see in this episode is kind of like poking them and like really kind of pushing them and challenging them and saying they shouldn't go this far. And then you have this species that also has a lot of power, not omnipotent, but they need to be kind of freed from this situation. So in a way, it's almost like taking a look at the different kind of extremes of first contact. Like, it could be there are these all-powerful beings that are a real problem, or it could be that there are these beings that you need to help out, right? As opposed to a being that can't really help them. you just have to hope that you can survive what they're doing. So anyway, what do you think, Joe? I think it's an interesting contrast between those two.
I think, does Q not want the crew of the Enterprise to kind of almost maybe turn a blind eye, or based on his historical knowledge of humanity, want Starfleet to enslave these creatures because he doesn't think we're up to much and we think we've gone too far and we're just a bad bunch of people.
He wants to see, to test them and see if they can figure out what's going on.
And I think at the end you see him, he's a bit annoyed that the fact that we've grown into ourselves, and for what he can see, we're not that species that warred against each other and drugged up our soldiers and had a nuclear world war.
And even says toward the end, like, oh, I see, I've made it too simple a puzzle. So then I think of him like going away for a number of years and be like, aha, I've got the perfect puzzle that he pulls in all good things. But but sure. It is pretty interesting that he's like, yeah. Well, maybe you can do that, but I'll be watching and we'll see what happens. So Joe, I'm curious, since we've talked about the two, what are your other two that you think are in this episode? I'm really curious.
So it's not like first contact between like Starfleet and another species. It's first contact of the original series with the Next Generation, with that lovely scene with Admiral McCoy and Data. It's just it's just so, there's something about it. It's like that lovely handover. Obviously, McCoy's 137 years old. He's just this wee old admiral now. And Data wants to be human. I think a lot of the original series was kind of this discussion on what it is to be human. And Data wants to be human as well. And he says about the Enterprise, like, the Enterprise is like a lady. She'll always bring you and the crew home. And it's just that, and they walk down the corridor together. It's just a lovely, poignant moment. Really enjoy
that's it. Very clever, Joe. I wouldn't have thought of that as a first contact.
I put it as my all moment, but not really a first contact, but that was like, I get what you're saying though.
Okay,
but I see what you're saying, Joe. It's kind of like outside of the universe, really. It's the audience seeing the contact between these two shows.
Yes. And I suppose the other one would be, because it's the first episode, it's our first contact with this new crew. And it's interesting because we only meet a few of them in the first episode. And then we meet a bunch of others in the second part. You don't meet Riker and Crusher, Wesley, and LaForge until episode 2, I think. So it's weird. It's spaced out unusually. I suppose it's such a big ensemble cast. You want to kind of drip feed them to the audience, maybe.
Yeah, you want to kind of like get everybody together little by little.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, that's my second one. I know it's not really a first contact, but
I see what you're doing.
I'm calling it.
That's funny. I actually had a section called Other First Contacts in my notes here. And one of mine was the crew getting together and meeting for the first time, which is also a part of us getting introduced to TNG. But then I also, I don't know if you remember, but in the holodeck, I think Riker, that was his first time meeting an android.
Or at least Data, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he said, I think they were talking about, I could be wrong, but I could have sworn I remember them saying, like, Data explaining himself to Riker, like, what he is, and them having a discussion about it, like, in the holodeck.
Because he says that, do you think you're superior to us? And Data was like, in most measures, I am superior, I'm stronger, faster, smarter, etc.
Yep.
One really weird thing that I noticed about Data was he didn't know what Snoop meant. And Picard says it, doesn't he? He says, how can you be programmed with all this knowledge and not know what Snoop means? It's in the dictionary. If you've got a dictionary installed, you know what it means. That was a bit odd. I suppose it just serves to highlight that he's not human and he's an android, so.
Yeah. All right. So we've talked quite a bit about Encounter at Farpoint, but there is a lot going on there in really the two parts of the episode. But let's move on to the next one, which is a season two episode, Pen Pals. So I guess just to give a little refresher to listeners, so there's this planet, Drama 4, that has all of this, these geological problems. Seems like the people on the planet are going to die, but Data in doing some research into different, I guess, frequencies that he can access, he has this conversation with this girl named Sarjenka, and like during the course of the episode, there is kind of this discussion about what is proper to do. Should they all die or whatever? But of course, in the end, they do come up with a solution to save everyone, including Sarjenka, whose memory is wiped. So. I mean, this is, you know, quite different, I think, in a lot of ways than Encounter at Farpoint, and maybe more what we would think of for a first contact. Like, there's a civilization that doesn't have space travel, and you have to deal with thinking about what first contact means, and, you know, it kind of happens by accident. So, April, like, what do you think about this episode, Pen Pals, and the first contact that happens?
Okay, well, I do think that this situation with the young girl and this planet really started out as more of a prime directive discussion and not necessarily a first contact, because the issue of first contact didn't really happen until like maybe about 32 minutes into the episode.
Although Data had been talking to her, so he'd already kind of made first contact.
Yeah, but that's kind of a prime directive violation,
yeah.
More so than a.
You know what?
I
was rewatching this episode, and like you get to the point where Data tells Picard, and he's like, "Yeah, I started talking to her 8 weeks ago," and I'm like, 8 weeks? Why didn't you say anything?"
Exactly.
But you know, whatever.
Like, yeah, and so because she still didn't know who she was talking to, because he was remaining vague of who he was, so she probably wasn't really sure of. Like, she could have been talking to somebody on the other side of the continent,
right,
for all she knew.
Exactly.
So it wasn't until he made actual contact with her that it become like a, oh, wow. Like, now you're going to add this level to it. And then it's also a kid. I don't know.
And it starts the whole thing that you will see in several of these where someone who doesn't have space travel gets brought up to the Enterprise, right? It seems to happen quite a bit.
Exactly. And I have some comments for later for wrap up with regards to that, because there's questions about, like, you know, how do you know that the whatever. I'll get into that later.
But I think it's interesting you're thinking of it more as prime directive centered in the first part of it than first contact, because I don't know, maybe because I was rewatching it, thinking it through the lens of first contact. That's how I was thinking. And then I was thinking of the prime directive issues coming up later. But yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, he started talking to this young girl who was like calling, saying, "Who's out there?" And well, he could have not said anything.
Well, you know, like, and there's this scene where it's like, "Is anybody out there?" And almost immediately he's like, "Yes." And I'm like, "Data, couldn't you just be like, oh, we're getting, let me record that and
share it and talk to the rest of the crew about
and
it.
Mute myself so she doesn't hear what I'm automatically saying, and then just bring it up in a meeting and see what we want to do." But he, yeah. But
exactly.
So Joe, what do you think about this episode and thinking about his first contact?
I really enjoy it. There's a part
it's
of
a good
it.
Episode.
There's the idea that you can talk into some kind of radio device and send your voice out into the world and out into space. And I think we've all done it. And we're wondering if there's going to be a response. So in terms of like human space exploration, we've sent the Arecibo message out. We've had the Voyager and Pioneer probes go out with the information about where we are and who we are and kind of what we're made of. And we are constantly looking for extraterrestrial life. So I think that's a bit of the episode that spoke to me, that there was this. Never mind that it's a young girl and she's on this planet, and our planet's falling apart. The idea that you're just looking for something, a voice in the darkness.
Yeah. Oh, and just like a little side thing to that, which is that she is doing it by like a radio frequency which travels at the speed of light. So maybe Data's been talking to her for 8 weeks, but maybe they've only had like a couple conversations, because it's going to take a while for the signal to go back and forth?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's over that planet that's fallen apart. My understanding in the episode was that it's like five star systems where there's something that's causing them to, Riker says, live fast and die young.
And they don't really tell us what that is, do they?
Yeah, because I watched it today and I was looking for, well, they're going to find a black hole or some quantum singularity that's kind of ripping the fabric of space apart, but they don't. They find dilithium in one of the planets, which accounts for that planet, but that one planet's
not
going to affect
all. Does that mean they destroyed a big dilithium deposit just to save the planet? I guess it would have been destroyed anyway if the planet got ripped apart.
We can recrystallize dilithium now, so mining of it's not so important. Oh, Justin, come on.
So April, like other things about this episode?
Well, I do. This is where the Prime Directive comes in. I get a little, I'm torn, like probably most people and probably most officers on a ship, with regards to like, do you interact? Do you not? Do you save the planet? Do you not? Do you, you know? And because I know eventually, I mean, granted, they were able to, you know, apply the Men in Black fix, you know, just you wipe out her memory.
Dr. Pulaski, can you do that? I guess so.
Not a problem. But sometimes you just have to, I don't know, do the right thing. And I think Picard admitted later that sometimes doing the right thing supersedes duty. Something that you just kind of have to, I don't know, just save the planet, save the people, do what you need to do.
I don't think the Prime Directive should be, if it was a real thing, be intended to be so black and white.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And like, I've gone back and forth about this over time, but like, when I think about it, I'm just like, okay, the Prime Directive's intention is to prevent harm to civilizations that could be exploited because they're at a lower level of technology or something like that, right? So if a planet is going along and doing its own thing and it would disrupt, you know, the society, their fabric, how they think about things, and or if you intervene, then I can totally see how it's like, hands off, let's not bother them. But if the planet's going to die, right, like, doesn't it do more harm for the planet to die than whatever other consequences there are for like millions of people to die? And also, like, as an aside, because I read a lot of the novels, there was a recent Enterprise novel where it's taking place like in the early stages of the Federation, but they haven't really gotten to the Prime Directive yet, but they're kind of debating this kind of thing. And as part of the debate, someone brings up like, well, what if like a whole planet's going to die? You know, would we not interfere then? And they all laugh and they're like, who would take it that far? You know, like, who would possibly do that? So I think that's an interesting idea that maybe like in future centuries, they've just have gotten really rigid and taken it too far. But I've definitely come to believe like, you need to think about it in terms of the potential harm. And if the potential harm that happens is everyone dies, then almost anything else that you can do would be better to try to save them. You know what I mean? So that they're not all dead and their culture is gone. So, yeah.
Unless you start thinking like the Krenim. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. They already didn't exist. It's no problem. We're good. Yeah, but like it's such an interesting question. Of course, if we ever do get to that level and we're seeing other societies, we'll have to think about how we deal with that. And I think that like the Prime Directive comes from a really good intention, which is the thinking about the history of the Earth and different colonial powers that have, you know, interfered and done all this harm and stuff. But I think you can take it too far. And it's almost like, well, okay, if this is the solution, like, can't we just keep doing that in the future, like just try to come by and fix their planet and try to wipe out any trace that we were there, but at least they're going to live on. I don't know.
I suppose that we're talking about human history on Earth. There are still tribes in the Pacific and South America that have had little or no contact with the outside modern day world. So if something cataclysmic was to happen to them, say there was a volcano, would we go in and save them? I would argue that yes, we should, because it's going to wipe out this tribe so that the tribe won't exist anymore. But if it was like the tribe were fighting amongst themselves, should you go in and help them then? If it's a natural disaster, then yes. If it's more internal politics.
Yeah, and Picard talks about that. He's like, okay, everybody's going to be wiped out on the planet. Those of you who object would go in and say, but like, what if there's a war that's going on? Would you intervene in that? You know, that could be kind of dicey and you don't know what the outcome could be, if you could make it worse or whatever. So it does become a difficult question. So we've probably talked more about Prime Directive stuff, but I mean, it only comes up because there is this contact that happens. Like if Data didn't have this contact and they didn't go by and see what was going on the planet, they would have no idea, right? And the planet would just die. So in this case, the unintentional first contact in a way helps to save the people, because Sarjanka puts this message out there, can anybody help? Anybody out there? And it actually saves her planet. So it's pretty interesting, because like there's also an encounter at Farpoint, like they're saving this enslaved species because of kind of this accidental first contact, right?
I suppose you could argue that Sarjanka sent out a distress signal. So she called for help, which kind of, in terms of the Prime Directive, you could ignore that black and white rule of the Prime Directive, because she asked.
And that's kind of what Picard ends up doing, because she does have more of a plea, like I'm afraid that, you know, all this stuff's going to happen. It's like, oh, sounds like a distress call.
And it's really interesting. I've mentioned it before, but the discussion they have in Picard's quarters, as opposed to having it in the observation lounge.
Yeah,
the observation lounge is obviously an official meeting place. Having it in the captain's quarters kind of takes it off the record almost, because they know they probably shouldn't be interfering. But given the nuances of the situation, they feel that they have to, which I think is fair enough. Because they do that quite a lot, where they have kind of off-the-book discussions, but it's in somebody's quarters, as if to keep it secret.
Definitely.
I don't think Data would have done that in the first place, having a conversation with somebody for 8 weeks without telling anybody. I'm not buying that.
Does seem a little odd, but... Okay, so let's move on to the next one, which is the third season episode, Who Watches the Watchers? So this is where you have the proto-Vulcan Mintakins, and they're being observed behind a duck blind by Starfleet, but the holographic shield, something happens to the power supply, it fails, and the Mintakins kind of end up finding out that there are other people out there in the universe, and they try to worship Picard as a god for a little bit, and then of course they do take someone up to the ship to see what's going on, and in the end it's like nobody's memory's wiped. It's like we're just gonna have to kind of deal with this, which is different than what happened in Pen Pals. So April, what do you think of this episode and kind of the impact of the first contact?
Fortunately, it wasn't our crew, Card and crew, that caused this issue in the first
the
place.
The accident happened from another group of
exactly,
people.
Exactly, from the observers that were there. And I struggle with this because I think, goodness. I mean, it needed to... Eventually, everything that happened needed to kind of happen. Like, the crew had to do... Picard had to do what he did and everything. But... he didn't realize, or he didn't think that they were, like, Picard was a god until he was already up in the ship and saw like the light behind Picard's head, and there was like a halo kind of thing, and it was just kind of like a strange moment, and he was just like, the Picard, you know. So his daughter saw Bev and him beam up out of nowhere, or disappear rather, from her perspective. And I don't think that they realized that there was a second person who actually witnessed this, because when they brought him up, they thought maybe he was really the only person, because she was hiding.
Yeah.
So,
but they tried to do some memory wiping that didn't quite work, right?
And I was gonna mention that, because like, well,
did Pulaski,
you know,
take her notes with her?
Exactly. Bev didn't get all of the details of that at all. But I think there was also a challenge, I think, because they're Vulcan or proto-Vulcan or what have you. So their minds might be different than the young girl who was at that Pulaski wiped.
And I wonder sometimes when I watch this episode if they treat them a certain way because they look like Vulcans as opposed to something else. And they think like, oh, this is a really logical species or something like that. But I don't know. So Joe, what do you think of...
trying to remember. This isn't the one, I watched this one recently within the last couple of months, so I didn't rewatch it for the conversation. Do they end up coming clean with the Mintakins?
Yeah.
They do, yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, so, like at the end, Picard's talking with him and he's like, well, you've just got to kind of do your best with this now. So, yeah, which I think was a bold choice to make, to just be like, it happened, it's going to have some consequences, and just got to do the best you can. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think once they realized that they couldn't wipe their memory anyway, they had to come clean pretty much at that point.
Yes, as a case, they've tried to fix the problem and then refix it, and then the problem just unravels more and more and more until it becomes unfixable. Mm-hmm. It's like trying to put band-aids on a severed limb. I mean, you can stick 100 band-aids on it, but it's like you're not going to do the patient any good. So the ultimate thing is to do is just go, okay, that's fine, made a mistake. We're here, the universe is full of people. Some of us have spaceships and you guys don't. That's just the way of it, but you're kind of proto-Vulcan, so deal with it. Okay, thank you, goodbye.
Yeah, and they seem to be like, all right, I guess we'll deal with it. Thanks.
Yeah,
I mean, it doesn't like totally lead to an upheaval in there, at least that we see in this episode. So
no, I don't think it would, because I think you're supposed to be given the impression that they are Vulcans, so they're logical, so they will be able to handle it.
Yeah, but they're willing to believe like Picard is a god up until the point that the guy shoots him with the bow and arrow. So
yeah, but like Vulcans used to be really violent and overly emotional, so. I suppose they're earlier on in their Vulcan evolution. So the fact that they believe in a god, because they don't have the scientific knowledge not to. What was it? Was it Asimov or Arthur C. Clarke? Now the quote about...
One of them.
It's undistinguishable from advanced technology.
Sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Let's actually keep going. I know we have have a few more episodes to go through, but I think that was an interesting contrast. So there's also the season 4 episode called First Contact, which basically the Federation has been kind of seeing where the society's going. They're on the verge of developing warp drive, or maybe even on the verge of testing it. And I think Riker had gone undercover. He gets discovered, and it kind of... leads to this upheaval in their society, and eventually they tell them to leave because there are these elements in their society that can't accept it. And I've often thought when I watch this episode, like, yeah, maybe if that happened on Earth, that would happen, where they would be like, oh, given the choice, like, please go away, because like we've got all these elements in our society that really don't like you being here. So April, what do you think of this episode?
Yep, that one actually noted that with regards to how they left. But I like this episode. It's a little, one part of it's really weird, but...
I think I know which part you're thinking of. But
yeah, the doctor that, like, quid pro quo. Oh my God, that, whatever. So anyway, so that was really disturbing. But outside of that, that's something that, you know, even with, you know, the manipulation of your physical appearance, you know, surgically to like make you fit in, you know, you never know when an accident's going to happen, right?
Yeah.
There's no real preparation for that. And so he ends up in the hospital and they find out that he is completely different than them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he wakes up.
It's almost
up
as if you just have prosthetics on your face and hands.
Oh no, it's as a, you know, what do you say, a genetic mutation or something like that. It's just like, yeah, no.
But it's kind of funny because in a way he is the person that just has prosthetics on and like an actor would, yeah.
Exactly. So it was really interesting, but I really do enjoy this episode just for the fact that it really challenges Starfleet and how they're going to do things and how they're going to move forward with things. And also, you know, hopefully makes them think about accidents can happen. These civilizations, especially one that is close to space travel or warp travel or what have you, they're going to have doctors. And if there's an accident, you know, they're not going to, you can't just kind of talk your way out of explaining why you have normal fingers and normal toes. And so I like the challenge that it places for Starfleet just to kind of okay, you know, what are we going to do next time? How are we going to avoid this? And, you know, should we really be having people down there for that long and that sort of thing? And then also, too, I really love the ending. I do. Like, I like how Picard's like, oh, we'll just step away. You know, good luck to your civilization. Hopefully, you know, we'll run into each other eventually in our lifetime, et cetera. But we're going to honor your request and not continue with interacting with your community or your environment. So I really do appreciate that ability to step away.
What are your thoughts on this one, Joe?
I really like the episode as well. The best bit is Marasta Yale. She is a Star Trek fan. She is a Star Trek fan of her species. She is the person.
Take me with you.
She is the person we all want to be. If like aliens came and visited, we'd be
like, if these beneficent aliens came and they were like, hey, we got this thing going on. You want to come with us? And you look at Earth today and you're like, yeah, I guess so. You know, like maybe there's better stuff out there. It's kind of how she feels, like, because she can't really fit in with this society that's going to suppress progress.
I think for me, I believe I was born like 200-300 years too early, because I'm fascinated with what the future is going to be like, and I know I'm not going to get to see it, because obviously human lifespans are
limited. I mean, I'm hoping
limited.
200-300 years from now is better, not worse. But
yeah, you'd have to. Star Trek gives us hope that it is going to be better.
Yeah, it does.
I was watching the Netflix TV show Mars recently. Have you seen it? Yeah, I highly recommend.
I want to.
Recommended. So it's part documentary set in 2016 and it's part drama set in 2035. So the documentary footage is all kind of thematic and about possible future missions to Mars and what NASA, the European Space Agency, all the space agencies around the world, and they interview scientists and engineers and astronauts about the logistics of a mission to Mars. And then it jumps to 2033, I think it is, and talks about the astronauts that are currently en route to Mars and when they land and set up camp and all that kind of thing. So really enjoyed it. So why I mention it is I told my mum and dad about it. And they, for some reason, had been speaking about Mars earlier and said, my mom said to me, your dad thinks that if NASA phoned you up and said, oh, we need somebody to go on this new Mars mission, would you go? And my dad thought I would go. And my mom thought, no, he wouldn't. He wouldn't leave his family behind. And I thought about it. I was driving home at the time and I was like, I actually think I would. I think the opportunity would be too colossal to turn down.
You'd need the astronaut training first, though.
Oh, yeah. Come on. I'll get through that easy.
No problem. That'd be easy.
Yeah. So I think the opportunity to, first of all, be in Earth's orbit and see the planet from space, which is something we see in Star Trek a lot. I think the psychological impact of that on a person can't be underestimated. And then to travel to another planet and land and then live on another planet. I know it's Mars, it's hardly any atmosphere. The gravity's like, what is it, a third of Earth? And it would be really inhospitable. But the opportunity, I would have to say yes to be a space, living my own Star Trek.
Well, we'll see, Joe. Maybe we can do that in your lifetime. And then you'll be a famous astronaut.
Yeah, but then I'd leave my dogs here. You know, it's a one-way ticket, essentially. You're not going to come back. Leave my dogs, leave you, and leave my extended family, my brother, sister, mum and dad. It'd be heartbreaking, but I think when you balance that up with the impact that you could have on the future of humanity, I'd have to say yeah.
And maybe we'll have a propulsion breakthrough, so it won't take as much time.
True. Maybe Earl Grey hosts will invent transporter technology and we'll just be able to beam
record
over.
The first podcast on Mars.
Yes. I actually did think about that. I was like, oh, what will I do like as a host of Earl Grey if I'm on this space mission? Will we do it? Well, Justin and Amy will record their bits and then they'll send it to me and I'll record my bits. Then I'll send them back and they can edit them together. Because obviously the time delay would be too much.
I mean, let's set it right now. Earl Grey, episode 3000 on Mars.
Oh, that's a lot of Earl Grey episodes. Do we have enough to talk about? Yeah, so I don't. I think the reason I mentioned that was because Marasta Yale is that is me, is the person that would say yes, take me with you, because my society. The episode is a case of first contact happening a couple of decades too early, maybe 100 years too early, when the society isn't fully ready. I think it's their society a bit like Earth just now. I think for the most part, there are some of us that are ready for first contact.
Yeah.
And then, but a lot of us that aren't ready. A lot of kind of.
Oh, yeah. The Star Trek fans would be ready. Everyone else might be like, I don't know about that.
True.
Okay. So I think it's been a really interesting discussion so far. But I realized as we went through this that there is an episode we wanted to talk about that I forgot. Sorry, listeners. And sorry, Joe and April. So, of course, it is the season 2 episode Q-Who, where we first see the Borg. And it's actually, I think, the very next episode after Pen Pals. So, of course, this is, you know, quite different because there's this really frightening adversary they can't really defeat. And Q has to kind of take them back. And it is interesting because you have the first contact with the Q in Encounter at Farpoint, and now one of the Q, played by John DeLancey, is creating a first contact. So, April, your thoughts on this one?
Well, this is actually, this was a very, I mean, even though the first time we saw Q, it was really a clear indication of the type of person that, or type of being that he was. As well as their capabilities as Q. But nothing really quite holds a candle to Q-Who and the fact that he can like throw their ship across quadrants. I'm not even sure exactly where they were.
They were somewhere in the Delta Quadrant.
I was thinking Delta, but I wasn't really sure because when they mentioned how long it will take, but maybe it's because of the certain part of the Delta Quadrant that they were in was closer than where
I got the impression Gangway. It was the Delta Quadrant, but somewhere not all that far from the border with the Alpha and Beta Quadrant. But
yeah. So, the fact that he just threw a tantrum because he wanted to join the crew.
He's like, oh, you'll need me after this.
Exactly. And I really, really like, that's our first introduction to Guinan's abilities of sensing something's off, at least if I remember correctly.
I think you might be right.
Yeah. And so I really like that too, just because she just knew, she's like, is everything okay? When she called the bridge and
like,
she was just kind of looking out and even... Geordi, when he was in the 10 forward, he was like, you know, I think I want to just go check engineering just because they have an idea of her abilities or capabilities. So that part of it I enjoyed. But then I also, the introduction of the Borg, because to me, I don't know how many fans, a lot of people seem to complain about the Borg. I personally like the Borg, just like their introduction and their interaction with Starfleet. And I know some things happen in Voyager later, but I really do like the interaction of the Borg. And I think they did well, but they also had coaching, even though Q was being really vague on the details. But I did appreciate their willingness to talk to Q, try to get information from Q, and then also Guinan, because her people had an interaction with them some 100 years ago. I think that was, I just found it interesting. They used their resources. They got some information about these beings, and they watched carefully and proceeded cautiously with, you know, trying to understand what this group of people or beings are.
Yeah, because I think originally, you know, Picard is almost like kind of trying to take it from the perspective of like, okay, it's a new species. Maybe I can do this diplomatically, but like nothing that he's used to works with this.
Not this at group. All.
So it's, you know, it's quite different in that way. And also happening early on, like this, you know, it's kind of like an Encounter at Farpoint. They're able to save the space jellyfish from being enslaved. In Pen Pal, they've saved a planet, even if, you know, they had to break the Prime Directive. But here it's like, there's nothing he can do. And he has to actually even admit to Q, like, all right, if you want to let to us to let you know that we need help. We need your help. If you want us to say that we're frightened, you know, like there is absolutely nothing that he can do here, which I think is, it's kind of like the first contact that can't possibly go well. So
exactly.
Your thoughts, Joe?
Yeah, I think this is one of the times where we see Q doing something that's just really bad. Because normally we see him and he's kind of just using the crew as a plaything and a toy and testing them in some way mm-hmm. with things that they can probably handle. But he does this thing to kind of force them into a situation they can't handle because he's just trying to prove that they're not ready for what's out there. But I think they wouldn't have met the Borg for another however long, because that system J25 is in the beta quadrant according to Star Trek star charts and Stellar Cartography, the books.
It's not in the Delta Quadrant?
No, it's in the beta quadrant, but it's quite close to a hub of the Borg transport network, apparently.
Mm. Thank you. That's what I was wondering.
Okay.
Yeah, because I thought they mentioned something different. So.
Okay. Q is right to say that they're not ready to handle everything that's out there. But it's only because he's forced them into a position and to not been able to handle it, because it wouldn't have happened until sometime in the future when they might have been ready for it. And then, so you could argue that Q is responsible for all the deaths at Wolf 359, because he alerted the Borg to the existence of the Federation.
Yeah, I mean, and 18 people die. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't restore them or anything like some people that die in other episodes where he's like, just bring him back. Yeah, it is one of those times where Q kind of seems a little more malevolent, but like in his way, he's like, I just want to warn you what's out there. So now you got warning, right? But yeah, it leads to...
Give us a warning. Do you know what I mean? Warn us, but don't throw us into something we can't possibly win.
He probably thought that was his way of doing it. But yeah, it is one of those cases in this list of first contact where it's like, there's some super serious stuff going on that sets up so much else later. Because in a lot of these cases, we don't really see these species again. Like, we don't see the space jellyfish again. We don't see Sarjenka's species. We don't see the Mintakans. We don't see the Malkorians from first contact. But this is one where this is like really important going forward, so that's pretty interesting. So let's keep going here to another one that's a threat, which is the aliens in Schisms, which is the episode where these aliens from I guess another realm are taking people while they sleep and doing experiments on them. So this is kind of it's something that Starfleet didn't ask for, but it is a first contact, definitely, at least at the point that Riker like is awake and sees them and deals with them.
You
so
can't call it a realm, Justin. It's not a medieval drama. It's a different layer of subspace.
Yeah.
Get your
a different subspace
right.
Realm? Yeah.
Okay.
That helps to me. To
I think realm, you think of like people on horseback and knights and princesses
different,
with long
different
hair.
Different layer of subspace.
Yes.
There we go.
Obviously.
So April, what do you think of this episode and thinking about it as a first contact?
They were completely violated. Like, and it's just a matter of pretty much just being attacked in a way without actual battle. But, these beings are just taking people and experimenting on them and just kind of quietly and clandestinely trying to, like, put them back in their place and, pretend like nothing's going on until there's, headaches and weird things that are happening and, triggers that seem to be happening to the crew, throughout the ship. So the first contact is like when Riker wakes up, like there's no negotiation going on. They're just trying to get out of there. They're trying to save themselves. And so I don't really remember an actual like diplomatic approach to trying to solve or whatever. It was just a matter of we're being violated. Our crew is being hurt. I think if I remember, one crew member was killed or something like that.
They end up dying, I think, because their blood was replaced or something crazy like that.
Exactly. And so, I'm not really sure if it was just a matter of life or death at that point, really. I mean, this was a lot worse than that other episode on Voyager. That
Scientific Method?
Scientific Method, yeah.
That was pretty bad,
too. It was pretty bad, too. I think somebody, I mean, there. I think a crewman died there, too. But just they were pretty much the same. But it was just, it was just horrible. And it was just a matter of them. At least with the Voyager one, they got to talk to the crew. I mean, to the beings.
Makes this really here, frightening. They don't. Yeah. They can't really communicate with them, because maybe they could be like, "Hey guys, why are you doing this?" You know, but they couldn't find out. So like, the only thing we can do is try to get our people back and seal it up and call it a
exactly
day.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was more of an escape attempt, an attempt at saving yourselves more than a first contact to me. But I mean, there was contact, but it was just saving yourself from violation, really. It was a very disturbing episode.
what do you think, Joe?
I think these subspace aliens are less of the aliens from that Voyager episode and more like the two-dimensional being from The Loss, which was dragging the Enterprise into quantum singularity.
Why so?
I think the Voyager aliens were sentient humanoid species from our realm of space. Let's use that word, realm, again. And so I think they probably knew that they were violating the crew to study science. But you could argue that being in another layer of subspace, they might have just viewed us as some kind of... Did they view us as life? Did they see us as like ants or less evolved living organisms that they wanted to investigate? And they couldn't have the ability to perceive us as being sentient and being on the same level as them. And I think the only reason that Riker saw them as being similar to humanoid is maybe that is just the way your brain processes the information when you wake up in subspace, possibly.
That's interesting. I've probably talked about it on this on Earl Grey before, but there is an explanation in the novels that makes it more I don't really have to go into it, but I think it does leave it open that they could be doing it for any number of reasons. It could be like you're saying, like they don't think of you know the beings that are in our layer of subspace, let's say, or our universe, don't think of them as on the same level, and you can do experiments and find out things. I mean, or it could be that they're trying to find out some information to help them move to our area because theirs is having a big problem. But they leave it open. It could be a lot of things. And that kind of makes it more frightening because you don't even know why they're doing this, right?
Mm. It's the creepiest point that Star Trek has when on the holodeck and like make a table. I don't know where the table database is in the holodeck, but it's like make a wooden table. And
it's reading their minds.
Well, it's just really strange. It's like completely random selections of catalog tables that they have, like make the table
ones that
metal.
They had on the like in storage at Paramount.
Yeah, like if you go to IKEA and you say show me a table, it just shows you random tables. But just the whole they're all sharing this experience adding to the details with the scissors, and one's a long blade and a short blade, and then there's a light, but the light's brighter and it's closer to the table, and then there's the clicking.
Oh god,
the clicking. It gives me chills.
It does.
It's so well done.
Yeah. And one thing that about that specific scene that really reminds me is like trauma when you're going to like, you know, any kind of therapy doctor, whatever, and you're going through a certain, if you've had a certain trauma and you're recalling and revisiting and trying to put the pieces together, because oftentimes with trauma, it's oftentimes kind of blocked out and you have the tendency to have to kind of rebuild it to understand what could have happened. And that's one of the things that really freaked me out about that specific scene, because it's like, you know, you have to kind of relive the feeling in order to put the pieces together. And that was something that really, really bothered me a lot. So, yeah, but it was just, I think it was done very well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's go to another episode, and this is the season 7 episode, Phantasms, which I think is another episode where there's kind of this mystery of what's going on. And I think you end up finding there are these interphasic organisms that have kind of are attacking them in some way. And Data kind of finds out through subconscious and his dreams and whatever what's going on, and they find a way to get rid of them. But April, what do you think about, and again, like we're talking about first contact, but they don't really I think get to talk to them, but there is this species that it's kind of like they're making first contact, but they don't really get to talk to them. What do you think?
Yeah. And I wasn't really sure if this specific species was, I mean, I could be completely wrong and maybe I'm looking at it completely different, but I don't really see them as sentient. They just kind of, I mean, they're definitely organisms that are in the ship. And I think, weren't they in the, some sort of warp, in the warp core or something like that? They kind of attach, and it kind of seems more so like an algae or something like that. That's at least how I envisioned this group of organisms. But it did lead to a very interesting adventure with Data.
And I love the technology where they can just like hop into his dreams. That's kind of cool.
That's pretty interesting. Yeah. I mean, this is one of the most memeable, I think, episodes. There's a lot of content in it.
With mint frosting.
Exactly. Yeah. And unlimited data. So, so I like their approach of trying to identify what the cause is, and how Data was somehow able to get, in some technical babble way, able to get Geordi to witness his dreams. I think it was Geordi.
Geordi and Picard.
And Picard, yes, because that's where the unlimited data comes from. So yeah, and from a first contact perspective though, because I just personally wasn't really sure if they were sentient, where you can actually have a conversation or some sort of diplomatic approach or something like that to address the beings. But it was more of a situation where they had to clear off the ship and like get rid of these things. And,
yeah, it's kind of like their first contact is finding out, oh, they are
infested, like
infesting and feeding on us. We have to kill them.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which is unusual for Star Trek to do. But
yeah.
Joe, your thoughts?
They're just the bug of the week, aren't they, really? Given a fancy scientific thing, they're not, so that I don't think they're ever meant to be sentient. Mm-mm. Unlike, so they're, I suppose they're similar in a way to the things Barclay sees floating in the transporter, which turned out were actually crew members.
Well, here's a question for you. So when Data is having his dreams, and it's almost like these organisms are represented by these workmen or other people are kind of communicating, that's just something that he's making up to interpret it, or is there some kind of communication being attempted?
I was thinking it was his interpretation.
Yeah.
Like that's his way of, you know, when you have dreams, right? You can have a dream about a freight train coming through your house when you're actually thinking about something else. It's more of a physical manifestation of your idea or thought of something. Like that's what I was thinking.
You're making me wonder why I put this one on the list.
Well, no, it's okay. I mean, it's interesting.
They're alive and it's the first time we see them, so
exactly. Yeah. Boom, first contact.
I have this dream. I have a recurring dream where I wake up in bed and behind the bed there's a hole in the floor. And when you look into the floor, like there's nothing. There's just this giant, giant chasm, this huge cave that's miles long and miles high. And there's a lake at the bottom and giant like stalagmites and stalactites. And it's lit from within because the crystals in the cave have this kind of internal ability to produce light. And then my vision zooms out and my house is just kind of perched atop this really thin layer of ground, and at any point it could collapse and I could fall into the cave.
Wow.
Just while we're talking about dreams and them being random and not really linked to real life.
Both beautiful and frightening at the
same time. Terrifying, yes.
Wow, that's really something. So,
it was just a dream that I had once. Yeah.
Now that we've talked about Joe's dreams, Okay, so one, of course, I had to include in here is the movie First Contact, and of course, thinking about first contact between humans and Vulcans, which is actually one of my favorite things in all of Star Trek, because it's kind of that moment where they go and start their journey toward a better future. But April, what do you think of this one?
Generally, this is, I find it's just a great movie. I love it. And it kind of gives the backstory. And it also offers like the Borg piece too, that I really enjoy as a part of this. But it's also like, I was thinking, not only is it the first contact of the Vulcans and all of that, but of course Starfleet had to get in there before the Vulcans did. And it is primarily, I think, because of the Borg, but there's a first contact with our future Starfleet and the beginning of what the beginning of our space. Exactly. And then also too, there's the Borg, because they're the few people who were involved with the flight, or the first, warp flight. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also got, oh, sorry, I thought that was muted. Start over. So,
April, you should have just said, come.
I know, but you that's my that's my geeky text. But it is Alfie Woodard, right? Yeah. Okay. She not only has the interaction that she's going to have later with the Vulcans, but then she also has the interaction with not only the crew of the Enterprise, but also the Enterprise itself and its capabilities and the holodeck, mm-hmm. and also with the Borg as well. There's a lot going on in this movie, and it's all of those pieces that I kind of thought about while watching the movie, because we don't really see the Vulcans until like the end of it.
That's true.
So therefore, there are all of these other first contacts that are occurring that I find really interesting.
That's a good point. Well, I mean, having first contact with the people from 2063 is one of a number of different first contacts with people from the past, whether it's in the 21st or 20th or 19th centuries. But I hadn't thought about it. That's an interesting way to think about it. And the Borg are there. And of course, if you go further and think about the Enterprise episode Regeneration, it kind of leads to a different first contact with the Borg, right? So these things get confusing. but you're right. It is more than just the humans and Vulcans. There are all of these other kind of first contacts going on. But what do you think, Joe?
That's interesting. It didn't occur to me that was a form of first contact, meeting the people from 2063. So that's a really interesting point.
Well, from their point of view, it's the first contact they've had with people in the future.
Oh, yeah, true. Okay.
Exactly.
Or, kind of, I suppose, aliens, because you see Worf and you see Troy on Earth.
That's
in the
true.
Past. So, yeah, it didn't occur to me. It's interesting. Alfre Woodard, her character, being plunged into kind of forced first contact of the future. Like seeing the Borg, seeing the holodeck, seeing the ship that's huge. It's got more titanium than she could ever imagine. What that does to your brain.
You mean you don't get paid?
Yes, exactly.
It's like inconceivable. She can't even like think like how do you even do that?
Yeah, how wonderful is this future that we live in? When I first saw it, I hated the theme tune. Hated it.
Really?
No, when I first saw it, because
you reformed yourself.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because I was thinking this, because the big thing about the movie is the Borg and fighting the Borg. So I wanted it to be some kind of warlike theme tune. But then, as you mature and as you appreciate the movie for what it is, it's about first contact. And when you see, it's so emotional though, when you see the Vulcan ship coming down through the clouds and then they land, and then there's a whole Vulcan salute thing. I'm tearing up just thinking about it. And then you go back and think about the theme tune. It's absolutely perfect. It's just, oh dear.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Love the movie. Mm-hmm. Love it.
Someday I'll speak, please.
No, I mean, those are all good points. And, you know, again, it's probably my favorite first contact we see in Star Trek, mm-hmm. or favorite scene, really.
Because you know what happened at some point. The whole movie is set up with this possibility of it not happening because of what the Borg are trying to do. And then it's not going to happen because they have to destroy the Enterprise, possibly. And it comes right down to the wire. And Data's been taken over by the Borg. And is he going to blow up the Phoenix? You don't really know. And then he doesn't, and it all comes good. And then the Vulcans arrive. So it's the first kind of contact you know has already happened, but it comes right down to that fact that it might not.
Make sure it happens again.
And history could have been changed, or the future could have been changed.
Or don't, April. Take us through this.
I think you could make the argument that the future's already changed. But anyway.
But I really, really, I really loved, and I can't remember the character's name, so sorry. Alfre Woodard's character Lily, when she was talking to Picard, they were talking about the Ahab and the Moby Dick story, and it was a really nice kind of bridge between her reality and world and Picard's reality and world, and them really connecting like that. I just kind of liked her character and just her reaction to being up there and the Borg, and like she was very real, I think, with like how somebody would react in that situation, as opposed to just going, oh wow, this is different, you know. She was very
And let's take a moment to recognize that out of the like eight things that we're talking about, episodes in one movie, half of them have someone from a pre-warp civilization going up to the Enterprise. It happens with Sarjenka and Pen Pals. It happens with Nurian, who watches the Watchers. It happens with Marasta Yale in First Contact. And it happens with Lily in First Contact, the movie. So it happens a lot, doesn't it?
It does. And I have questions about the transporters, especially with some of, at least with a human, they know that, you know, the transporter is going to be able to break a human down and like recreate it on the ship, or vice versa, right? Where like some of these other aliens that they were not familiar with, like I just find it interesting that they knew that the transporter is going to be completely safe for this person. Well,
I like to think that they've had experience with hundreds of different species and they have some way to
calculate
it. Do a pre-scan or something to make sure it's good. I don't know.
Exactly. It's like the universal translator. It's just got experience of so many languages that it just knows how to speak all of them.
Yeah, and as soon as they start with word one, it knows what to say. Yeah. So
this Star Trek nonsense is a piece of rubbish, isn't it? We'd never watch that.
I love it. Actually, I love it, to be honest.
Suspend disbelief. That's what we do.
Yeah, you have to do that. So yeah, I think this has been a great discussion. Again, we haven't talked about all of the possible first contacts. I can think of some off the top of my head that we didn't talk about, but I think it's been, like, I've been interested in thinking about this topic for a while of first contacts and just looking at it through that lens for the next generation. So let's talk about our final thoughts. So Joe, you want to go first?
Yeah, it's first when you pose a topic for a podcast, it's like, and each of us does our research on it. We don't know what the other people are going to say necessarily, so you don't know where the conversation is going to go. And like all topics, it's always gone in a way that I didn't necessarily think it was going to go in. And that's what I like about it, because you're opening yourself up to enjoying other people's opinions and getting to see other views and other takes on what Star Trek is. And so it enriches Star Trek, even though it's already enriched my life so much to this point. Like, April, your views on it has given me another little insight and made it all the more better. So, super interesting discussion today. Thanks for coming on.
Okay, excellent. So, April, your final thoughts?
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed this discussion, just because it's what Joe mentioned, as well as, not it was a pretty involved conversation for my first time.
But you did great. You did great.
My first contact with an actual podcast, just being a visitor podcast. I really, I will be looking at some of these episodes with a different lens after having this discussion, which is something that I oftentimes kind of do listening to Trek FM and the various podcasts anyway. But actually having the conversation and having some of my thoughts bounced off of you guys, it's really going to bring a different view point for me next time I watch these episodes, and especially the movie. I really enjoyed this chat. This has been great.
April, it's like what you said at the beginning. You watch Star Trek for enjoyment. Like, you don't necessarily have to watch it and pay attention. You just let the details wash over you and you take sustenance from that. But, like, I've not been podcasting for very long, so I'm still like, oh, I actually have to have kind of coherent thoughts about something and make notes, and, like, I have to actually pay attention and get to the details and come up with things to say. So
yep, I was really nervous about
yes,
that.
I feel your pain. I'm still a bit like that as well. So
yeah, but you did great. So a few of my final thoughts. So I think it was interesting to take a look at this list and kind of the breadth of different first contacts. So you have one that starts out with an omnipotent being, but then you have other ones with pre-warp civilizations where they are nowhere near the level of the Enterprise. You have others where there are kind of malevolent intentions, like with the Borg or these interphasic organisms or, you know, the schisms aliens. And then you have something going all the way to the first contact with the humans and the Vulcans. And I like how you guys were talking about different kinds of first contacts, like the, you know, first contact between the people in 2063 and the people in the future and things like that. So it kind of helped me to think about these things in a different way. And I think it's great, probably as always in these discussions for the Next Generation, that they didn't just do a topic like first contact one way. They did it in a lot of different ways with a lot of different kinds of species that have different kinds of power and ways of thinking about things and whether they're a threat or not, and how you think about it. And of course, there are others that aren't on this list. Like ones that I thought of were the nanites in Evolution, which are kind of a new, even though they'd been around, but and also like the microbrain species from Home Soil, you know, the ones that call us ugly bags of mostly water.
Ugly and bags probably of mostly water.
Yeah, and Joe loves to do that. so there are a bunch. And I mean, listeners, you know, hopefully the ones that we've covered here today were interesting ones. But if there are others that are your favorites that we haven't talked about, you know, drop us a comment or send us an email. We'd be interested to know, because as I started to think about it and list it out, I think there are quite a few others because of the nature of what Star Trek is. They're going where no one has gone before, kind of thing. But I think it was great to get this whole perspective on first contact, and it's really just an excuse to talk about Star Trek, and we love that. So April, it was really wonderful to have you on Earl Grey today. We really appreciated it so much, loved your thoughts, and hopefully we'll have you on again in the future. But let our listeners know where they can find you online.
So you can find me in the Babel Conference. I'm usually just a liker in there. I just go through liking things. I'm not very engaged. But you can also find me on Twitter at TAA0148. I talk about Trek. I really haven't been that active on there lately, but I do talk about Trek as along with some other things. Those are pretty much the places you can find me.
I'm really bad at using Twitter. I still don't, like, I'm on Twitter just now trying to find you, and I don't even know how to add somebody.
You guys, I love Twitter. I'm on there every day.
Yeah, well, I kind of backed away from it a little bit.
Just click on the search bar, Joe. And yeah, so thanks again, April. It was really wonderful to have you on Earl Grey today.
Thank you. I hope I can be back.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You'll be back. You were amazing. A natural, I would call you. And also, you have a new friend on Twitter.
Yay.
All right. All right. So a preview of next week's episode. Do you want to talk about that, Joe?
Yes. So my favorite thing about Star Trek is all the science that's been in it. And we will be continuing our science series with part 5 of the science in TNG. I think we're going to be talking about a few episodes from the end of season 7. So I'm really looking forward to that. Yes.
Yeah. I love those discussions. So definitely looking forward to it.
I love how you and Amy always like go away having like learned stuff about science. So, and it's all stuff you've never really thought about before. So that's cool.
And you do all the prep and I just show up. So
yeah, you and Amy just like turn up and I'm like, hey, science. I'm like exactly. Bill Nye, the science guy of the Star Trek podcast world. So
yeah.
Except my name's not
Joe
Bill
Keegan,
Nye.
Joe Keegan,
the science guy. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, it's been so much fun talking with April Taylor about first contacts in The Next Generation today, but that isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. Here's what you might have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Literary Treks. I knew from the beginning it was going to be a very large and complicated undertaking. I was asked by the editor and the licensor to come up with a storyline for Picard that would deal with the fallout of what I unleashed in my novel Section 31 Control, in which Section 31's crimes, and in fact its very existence, are publicly exposed to the Federation at large as well as its interstellar neighbors.
Earl Grey.
Troy looks down at her empty stomach.
Let me do this part. I'm going to act it.
Okay. Troy looks down at her empty stomach and frowns telepathically.
Oh, I wish.
Listeners,
could.
You couldn't see it, but I did that.
Oh, okay.
LaForge. Computer, locate a big thing of chips. To the journey!
What about the basics planet?
That planet's not bad. There's a lot of wide open spaces. You just have to avoid going in the caves.
Yeah. I mean, anthropologically speaking.
No spelunking on that planet. You can spelunk on the Borg Unicomplex, but you can't spelunk on that planet.
No.
The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
That he's...
He was taking the new body out for a ride?
Yeah, that was great.
I mean, it was a great line. It just doesn't really fit what really happened. Like, he wasn't out there dating other people, you know? Like,
well, he was trying to figure out who this new Culber was, you know?
No, I know, but it,
it was like funny, it was lighthearted.
It just doesn't fit what he actually did.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop Apple Podcasts app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. That helps others to find the show.
If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, YouTube, and most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up.
So, Joe, you want a bonus question?
Do you know, I was thinking today about where does the bonus question land? Because it's never in the outline. So, and it's always
like
a surprise.
To surprise you.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's bonus time. Go.
So Joe, thinking about first contacts today, what is a kind of first contact you can think about that you've had in your own life? Thinking about how we went a little beyond the boundaries of, you know, with an alien species.
Mm-hmm. It has to be like going to Star Trek conventions, doesn't it?
It does. What I was
it has to be
as well.
Like the first time you meet like people you've only seen on TV. Somebody that I love to talk to every year is Armin Shimerman's wife, Kitty.
Oh yeah, Kitty Swink.
Kitty Swink, yeah. She's just, do you know what, we've spoke to her a few years running now, so she'll see you in the corridor and she'll run up and like, oh, how are you guys doing? Her and Nicole DeBoer, who I get a selfie with every year in Vegas. Just it's these dead easy relationships you have with people. Because you're all there for the same reason. I know the actors are getting paid to be there, but they make the effort and they know you're there because you love Star Trek. So it's about meeting all the actors and then meeting the fans as well, because we're all amazing. What about you?
Yeah. I was thinking about Star Trek conventions. I mean, particularly the first time I went to STLV, which was, didn't know what to expect, meeting some people I hadn't seen before, and everyone just made me feel so comfortable. But it was like a first contact, because it's such a different place to be where there's people that are there for the express purpose of Star Trek. Like, that's the only time of year that happens, where I'm just surrounded by people that are all there about... I mean, it kind of happens in a way as a virtual convention, like on social media sometimes. But to actually see everybody in person and to be there, it's like a wonderful... It's a first contact that goes well. It's not like, you know, the Borg, because that didn't go well.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Nothing like that.
So we both had the same one. That's...
Yeah, it was what I thought of as well. Easy because, pick. Yeah. Oh, well. I'll try to make it more challenging next time.
Oh, no.
So if you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Earl Grey. That will come right to us, and we might read your email on the show. You can also find the network on Twitter and Instagram at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. So, Joe, where can people contact you when you're not trying to brush up on your diplomacy for a first contact?
Do you know what? I think I'd be really terrible at first contact.
Think
like,
so?
I'd do the wrong thing. Yeah, I'd like...
It's okay. You just be like, hi, how's it going? Try a Jaffa cake.
I take Jaffa cakes, but it would turn out like the species was intolerant to oranges and I would have wiped out the entire civilization.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'd be horrible. Yeah. I'd be like the Zap Brannigan from Futurama. Mm. I would be like him and just get it all wrong all the time. So when I wasn't, okay.
You'd be a science officer. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. I'd be somebody in the background that doesn't have a lot of responsibility.
Just to add like the Science 2 console in the back.
Yes, I'd be. Boop, 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 boop. Yep.
Oh, did you hear there was a first contact? It went really well. Oh, glad I wasn't part of that. I would have killed them.
Exactly. Accidentally, not because I've got this really dark side where I want to space everybody.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
So when I'm not brushing up on my diplomacy skills, you can find me on Twitter at joeyjoe77uk. You can email me, joepodcasts@gmail.com, or you'll occasionally get me on the Babel Conference. And Justin, where can people find you when you're not trying to sneak into duck blind missions?
I don't think I want to sneak into those duck blind missions. I have a real problem with, I don't know, just watching people and them not knowing that I'm watching them, so I wouldn't go on the duck blind.
That's why I wear my sunglasses. I watch people all the time. Behind the anonymity of my sunglasses that I've got on,
mm-hmm.
It works.
But they could probably see you across the street. It's different.
But no, I'm convinced I'm cloaked when I've got sunglasses
okay.
on. Can't see me.
All right. Well, when I'm not avoiding a duck blind mission, you can find me elsewhere on the network co-hosting The Line. That's our Star Trek Picard podcast with my friends Chrissy DeClercq-Zalagi and Brandon Shea Matala. We have a great time talking about things leading up to Picard, like things from The Next Generation and Voyager. And it's coming up soon, Joe. Let's see. This episode comes out on December 10th. A little under a month from then is the first Picard short trek. So this thing is coming. And when it does, on The Line, we will talk about each of the episodes as they air, including the short trek. You can also find me on Twitter. I'm at TrekFan4747, where I tweet about nothing but Star Trek. And you can find me hanging around the Babel Conference on Facebook.
So tell me, Justin, have you read the Countdown prequel graphic novel?
Yes, Joe. You know what?
What?
I got it the minute it was available. I think it became available at midnight on, what was it, November, whatever day it was, 27th. So, and I'm 2 hours behind Eastern time. So I checked, thinking it would be out at 10 p.m. And shortly after that, I started reading and tweeting about it. So yes, I have at the first opportunity.
Good.
Did you?
Yes. That wasn't really in my peripheral vision about it happening. I stumbled upon it because like everything on Facebook and Twitter is Star Trek related. So yeah, got it. Really disappointed in that it was so short.
There's three parts to it, so...
I know this is only part one, but I wanted to... Like, it took me 10 minutes to read it, and I was like, more.
Yeah, but that's how comics often are. It takes you a short time to read it. But I know, you want to be immersed in it, but,
yes.
You know, soon enough we'll have hours of Picard content. But
it was
really good. I enjoyed
to see it. See everybody, absolutely. What they're doing. If you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
We'd like to take this opportunity to recognize our current associate producers, Norman Lau, Michael Huter, Thomas Appel, Chris Trabuzio, Jim McMahon, Joe Keegan, and me, Justin Ozer. Thank you for supporting Trek FM, and especially Earl Grey. So join us next time for another cup of Earl Grey.
You broke your little ships.
First contacts are only impossible until they're not.